أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الهمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد وعلى بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وعداهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. فصير في الأرض فانظروا كيف كان عاقبة المكذبين. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. Bridging today's generation gap has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 10. And we first of all send our condolences to the Imam of our time, to the Maraje, to all of you, on today being the day of the wafat of Ummul Mu'mineen, Bibi Khatija, salamu ala alayha. And it is a extremely important day for us to recognize this great lady. There will be, inshallah, a very short noha after the majlis, and I have requested that personally myself because of the fact that it is a great loss for the Prophet. As many of you know, the Prophet of Allah for 1 year grieved for this loss of her of his. And inshallah, during Masai, we'll speak a little bit about the greatness of this lady, but it is important that we give her her due respect. Recite one last salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. Our conversation, our discussion since day number one has been revolving around this generation gap. And we have done our best to tackle those main contemporary issues that affect all of us today. It doesn't matter if you are an individual who comes from the previous generation trying to raise kids or grandkids, or if you yourself are the child being raised by that generation. There is, and there always will be, this gap that exists between two generations. And we have talked everything about communication, how we should communicate, how we don't communicate, the active listening that we need to have, and the idea of emotional intelligence. And for the past two nights now, we took another subtopic of culture and Islam. And we talked two nights ago about the fact that Islam was never a culture by itself, but rather a civilization. It came, of course, to either alter existing cultures, or adopt them, or flat out reject them. We give examples of pre-Islamic Arabia, we give examples of Islam in America. And last night I gave you two examples of cultural items that I found that we adopt from our respective countries that we still haven't quite let go of yet in this part of the world. Number one is how we do our weddings, number two is how we treat our spouses inside the homes. Going along with this idea of culture today as well, I wanted to bring up a topic that we'll talk about for the next one or two nights. I don't have much time today. We have Masaib, we have Anoha. We're going to be done all that before 8:30. So inshallah, you'll follow me. I'll go a little bit fast. But if I'm off by 8:15, 8:20, that's the ideal time for one Anoha, 5 minutes long. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. You see, the common complaint that I find from our elders in that generation is that my child, or the generation in which my child belongs to, has become a very selfish generation. And the child of today says that my parents are obsessed with what others might think of them. And this, of course, talks about a broader topic of the idea of individualism versus collectivism. It's a whole discussion. And one of the biggest gaps that we find culturally is the fact that this generation seems, today's generation, seems to be all about the individual, whereas our elders and their elders were concerned about the collective group at large. So for example, many times when a youth makes a decision, there are only a handful of people that he's thinking about or she's thinking about who will be impacted by that decision. Be it the person I marry, or be it, let's say, where I work, or be it, let's say, my lifestyle. Whereas my parents in the audience from back home, all of you, before thinking twice about anything, you would think about not only your nuclear family, but the broader family. And then, of course, even the streets that you used to live on, the neighborhood you'd be concerned about. And this obsession almost came from the idea that, like I said, if you're not talking, lo kya kahenge, what will people say about what we're doing? And so literally they would stop and block their own progress, our elders would, if they for a moment believed that by my decision, by my actions, those around me might give my name or my last name a bad name. So they would suppress whatever desires they might have. If that meant that they had somebody in mind for marriage in the streets of Pakistan or India, but they know that my mom and my grandmother or my dad or her mother would never accept that, they would drop that girl or that boy. But this generation isn't quite like that. They're concerned a little bit more about the individual and maybe a tight circle around them, not so much about anything beyond that. And so this whole debate that happens in both psychology and in religion, on ayah, are we concerned about the individual only or concerned about the collective nature at large? Should we be concerned about other people in our community, in our family? Or is it the case that no matter what I do, they'll never be happy with me, so why do I care? Many times parents come to me and say, you know, Milana, this child of mine, he's done this act, like he's married somebody, let's say, outside the religion, but he hasn't realized that we have to take the brunt of it from the extended family. He's married, he's gone on his honeymoon, he'll live his life. But forever, whenever I walk into Bayt al-Qa'im, people look at me whispering, they'll come and approach me. I have to live with these people, he doesn't. And so there has to be an element of the collective nature where, yes, you have to worry about what other people might think. Now, oftentimes my youth says, who cares? Why are you so obsessed with what other people might say? Like, really, mom, you don't want me to do this because Bayt al-Qa'im people might not accept me? But that's exactly how they were raised. They were raised a collective first, individual last. This generation is the complete opposite. Individual first, collective later. If the collective doesn't understand it, then so be it. So this whole debate within the culture of individualism versus collectivism is a whole discussion. We're going to expand that a little bit, talk about the pros and cons, and what does Islam say about this? On one side, we see the deen is very infiradi, very individual. But on the other side, the deen is very ijtimai, very social deen. Is there an element in the deen where you should only be concerned about the individual? Or is there an element where you should only be obsessed with those around you? Right? So let's open this topic up. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, in the individualism point of view, the main focus obviously is the individual. When they make crucial life decisions, very rarely do they think about those, of course, who are about the individual. Very rarely do they think about anything else. Even sometimes the parents, they believe that, look, fine, initially my parents will be upset, but eventually they'll get over it. They're parents, they'll accept me eventually. Right? That way I'll have the best of both worlds. I'll have the person I want in terms of marriage, I'll have the career I want in terms of my career, and after about 6 months, a year, even 2 years, they'll also kind of jump on board. All of this is that everybody else must adjust to the individual. So the idea of self-promotion and self-elevation is not only a part of the individualistic movement, it's almost mandatory. That's why we live, and one thing that, you know, that we don't accept from the American culture is that this is very much an individual culture. It promotes the individual. Everything from family values to orientation to everything. It constantly tells our youth that you should never let anyone else dictate to you what to do, where to go, who to love, where to spend your money, etc., etc. Whereas our parents are like, no, you have to worry about everything else. Because our name, hamara naam jo hai, it'll be dragged in the mud. But our the youth of today don't really concern themselves about that. So while we accept many things from this culture, one thing that we don't accept from the American culture is the idea it very much promotes the individual and only the individual. So yes, we live in a marketing era. We live in a self-promotion era. Social media has taken off because it is a self-promoting tool. You are now a brand. I've oftentimes said this. You are now a brand on social media. So pictures where you've been, stuff that you have bought, even meals that you've cooked has to be shared by the entire world. Before you can take a bite, just wait. I have to take a picture of the table and share that on Instagram. Hashtag lunch with the parents. Right? And so all this idea is that look what I'm eating, look what I've bought, look where I'm going, look who my best friend, look who I married. It's all about the self, self-promotion. The collectivism, it comes in about that I am very much second. It's the broader group that is more important to me than anybody else's. So many, many times, my elders talk about the fact that back in my day, even if I had a desire for something, if for a moment my parents told me that you can't have this, I squashed it. Now that's one extreme, right? One extreme is that sometimes my parents in the audience are obsessed about other people thinking about them to the point where, they almost create unhappy moments inside their home. And they're after individuals that will never truly be happy with you. The idea of people being happy with you and accepting you is always very relative. The same person today beside you who's very much in your corner is the same person next week who will be your enemy. And that's the reality of it. The insan fluctuates. The insan is moody. He's seasonal. He changes constantly. The one constant that is easy to please is Ya Sadi al-Ridha, is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so if we direct the happiness towards Allah, then of course, it's a different outcome. So a lot of my parents go to the extreme sometimes in thinking that, I have to please everybody. If there's one person who might not be happy with what I decide, then don't do it. And the other extreme, of course, is that let's forget about everybody out there and let's worry about the individual. It is a gap. It's a battle at home. Right? Simple as a wardrobe coming to Bayt al-Qaim. If you're not dressed the way that your parents want you to be dressed as a child, your parents say, that's not good to wear at Bayt al-Qaim. What will people think as you're dressed like that? They'll think, it's Kimabab Niyya. His parents aren't there. Otherwise, he would never let him come like this at Bayt al-Qaim. Even when it comes to spouses, right? If we don't iron our shirts as husbands, people will complain, do you not have a wife at home to iron your shirt? So it's all about the extreme. Even everything from the meals that we eat to everything, what if somebody sees us? There is an extreme out there. But the other extreme is a very selfish, egotistical approach to the world. It's me, it's myself, it's I. And so this me versus we comes about. And my parents were raised in a very we environment. And this generation is being constantly fed a very me environment. Is there a common ground? Come to the deen now. The deen is a beautiful balance between the two. On one end, the deen is absolutely individual. It's you and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Nobody else will accompany you in your grave. Nobody will ask you in your grave what your last name was. Nobody will ask you your three or four nasl and generation. Doesn't matter if your dada was an alim, what did you do in this world? On the flip side, there's very much a social atmosphere when it comes to the deen. So I'll give you a very simple example, like the fiqh of namaz. As you recite one loud salat, please come a little bit forward. Please, sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Sorry? Okay. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So if you examine the fiqhi rulings inside the furu of the deen, it's an amazing balance that deen presents to all of you. Number one is when it comes to salat. Salat is a very much individual journey towards you and Allah. It's a mi'raj for you. Even within the fiqh of wudu, which is the prerequisite of salat, look how individual that wudu is. Nobody can come even and pour water for you. Your wudu is batil. Nobody can come and hold the water fountain as you do wudu. You have to do it yourself. It's a very individual journey. As long as you're alive, nobody can make up your fast and your salat. While you're alive, that qaza is on your shoulders, not anybody else's. When you leave the world, then it falls on the shoulder of your eldest son. So even within that same furu, there is a very individual movement. But that same furu down the line talks about amr bil ma'ruf, which is absolutely a collective movement towards the deen. So Islam comes about, and neither is it me nor is it we, it's a collection of those together. It is a balance of those together. Now, the idea is that at what moment do I come across to me, and at what moment do I come across to we? Because the reality is that we've forgotten about the fact that we are not just individual Muslims, we're an ummah at large. We should be concerned about the person beside me, but we're not, because we're a product of this culture. And this culture says to mind your own business, to each his own. Don't worry about what's happening in that backyard, worry about your own backyard. We think for a moment, incorrectly mind you, the individual lists do, that I have a tough enough time fixing my akhirat, I have to worry about this guy's akhirat. I have a tough enough time keeping, you know, the hellfire out of my grave, I have to worry about this guy's grave. And we actually believe for a moment that, you know, I'm sorry, I'm not concerned about you drowning, I'm just happy that I know how to swim. It's become a very individual approach to the deen. And the deen, we don't sometimes understand the idea that sometimes when you help others towards the good, it's like you're helping yourself towards the good. Think about this hadith by our Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. I mean, there's small little hadiths, but they're so powerful. He says, "Dallu ala khairin kafa'ilihi." The one who guides towards good, the one who guides others towards good, is just like the one who's done that good himself. It's just like the one who's done that good himself. Islam always came about to squash the individual and talk about the ummah. You are an ummah, you're not an individual. You should be concerned about your neighbor's well-being. You think about, within that same salat, how many times more thawab does it have for a jamaat prayer? Why? It's in a collective prayer movement. You think about the idea that the Quran talks about the fact, كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةً, you are the best of nations. What makes you the best? أُخْرَجَتْ لِلنَّاسِ تَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفَ تَنْحُونَ عَلَى الْمُنْكَرِ وَتُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ. What makes you the best is not your individual salat, or not your individual fast, or not you going for hajj individually, no. What makes you the best is that you are worried about the khair, you enjoin the good, and you forbid the evil. That you collectively go towards good. That's what makes you the best nation in the eyes of Quran. So we have to really begin to understand that this is a brotherhood and a sisterhood. It's one of the lost wajibats that we have inside of our deen. I talked about that in Muharram, I'll talk about it again. In this world of self-promotion, people are not only committing sin, but like I said 2 nights ago, they're exploiting that sin. They're announcing it. They're publicizing it. They're publishing it. They're marketing it. Say, look what I've done. Right? And the glamorization of sin is where we live in today. And back in my elders' era, everything was private. Everything, even pictures taken sometimes. My mother for the longest time would not stand in front of a camera. The longest time. She doesn't know where that picture might go. Full hijab, properly covered, no makeup, doesn't want to take that picture. Now you might think that's extreme, but that's the mentality they're coming from. It's a very protective, private atmosphere. But in today's day and age, you take that picture where you shouldn't be taking the picture, and mashallah, it's going viral. It's all over the world. And we don't stop to even ask for a moment that does this person need help. We're watching individuals drowning in the ocean of kufr and shirk. We're watching families who are moving away from the deen. We don't have the culture to even say, is everything okay? We don't even have the culture to fix somebody's salat. If somebody, let's say for example, is doing sujood wrong, or ruku wrong, or wudu wrong, try it for a moment. Try approaching somebody in the bathroom here at Bayt al-Qaim and saying, you know what, you didn't do a masah of your feet properly. What kind of reaction will you get? Very rarely do we say, you know what, thank you very much, brother, let me go check with Mawlana and make sure my masah of my feet is correct. The majority of us will become very defensive. Because that's my individual wudu. Now a lot of you will sit there and say, you know what, it's my life. It's my freedom. This whole idea of freedom is also another cultural thing that we reject in America. This notion of absolute freedom, it doesn't exist. But individualism, that it's all about me and me and me and me and me, it breeds egoism. It breeds self-love. And that's the era that we live in. We live in a very conceitful, egotistical era. Humility and humbleness is very, very hard to find. Inshallah, when we understand the musibat of the woman that we're here to commemorate, you'll see that she was never concerned about the individual. She was always about the collective. She was given prime opportunities to separate herself from the Holy Prophet, but she chose not to. The hadith that I read for you in Muharram, Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, where he says, the haqiqat of iman, the haqiqat, the reality of iman is this, that you tread the path of haq and truthfulness, even if for that moment it might be detrimental for you, as opposed to you treading the path of falsehood, even if for that moment it might be beneficial for you. If right now it's beneficial to be quiet about Gaza, for example, about Yemen and Bahrain, for example, it's beneficial. Nobody really labels you, nobody really mocks you, nobody talks. It's beneficial. Imam Sadiq said, the haqiqat of the iman is that you tread the path of speaking out for the oppressed, even if in this day and age it is detrimental for you. This was a woman, a lady, who stood beside the Holy Prophet every step of the way. When he would come home after a long day of having feces thrown at him, garbage thrown at him, called the sahir, a magician, called the majnoon, a lunatic. Sorry, these words are not munasib for him. He would come home, and obviously it's a very stressful day. And she would automatically come in and create this mahalle sukoon for him, this maskan for him, this serene place for him. She would come, sit him down. Some say she would massage his head. She would give him a blanket, lie him down, get him rest, give him some water. To the point where years after she passes away, he still talks about her. It would drive the other wives crazy. Then why do you talk about that old woman? She died years ago. And he would get upset that she was there for me when nobody was there for me. When they were banished from Mecca, the Holy Prophet, for 3 years they lived in the Pisgah Shibir Abu Talib. If you read any history, you know it was the most difficult time in the entire prophethood. It was 3 years at Shibir Abu Talib. This was a valley that had no water, that had no resources, extreme weather, everything. Completely cut off. Sanctions, economic sanctions, social sanctions, everything. They would go and try to buy food from Mecca, and they would deny them food. It was the generosity of Sayyidah Khadija that got them through those years. But forget that. Before that, it was the Quraysh that had approached her and said, look, this banishment, these sanctions are not for you. They're for the Bani Hashim. You're not the Bani Hashim. You are in five generations, but you're exempt from that. You can live peacefully inside of Mecca. You can be the individual that you need to be. And her response is beautiful. Where my Muhammad goes, that's where I go. If he goes through that, I go through that. The first female to accept Islam. The first one to stand beside the Holy Prophet in Jamaat prayer, knowing full well that they would lay out tax, sharp tax, where he would pray Salat. And he would come and he would actually start to bleed. This was a woman who was very much about the collective nature of the deen. Give up everything for the greater good. Why is a shaheed so elevated in Islam? A shaheed does what? The ultimate sacrifice. Removes the individual, sees the collective. Sacrifices itself and sees the collective. As difficult as it is sometimes to sacrifice your own family, sometimes it's even more difficult to sacrifice yourself. So the maqam of martyrdom, of shahadat, is there because it removes the individual and it presents the collective. I ask all of you who take the me aspect and not be concerned about those. There are people in your community who are suffering and you know they're suffering. We just don't have the culture to pick the phone up, to text. Is everything okay? You don't seem yourself. You seem quiet. I haven't seen you at Baitul Qaim in weeks. What's going on? I've heard you lost your job. Send me your resume, maybe I can send to a few companies. If you do that, great. But the collective culture is that, you know what? Mind your own business. To each his own. Worry about yourself. He'll be okay. That's the American culture. It's not the Islamic culture. There are certain cultures in this country Islam outright rejects. One of them is pushing the individual. We reject the individual. We say the individual is individual when he belongs to a collective ummah, a nation, where we are concerned about the growth of the group, not only the individual. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So we have to understand that when I help somebody else reach their goals, it's like I'm also reaching the same goal. So this notion that I'm using all my resources for this guy and not saving for myself, that doesn't exist. Because the moment that you're helping out another brother reach his destination, it's like you've reached that same destination. Help the person get to the destination. Right? The Sira of Amir al-Mu'mineen, these small stories we tell our kids are so profound and so powerful. He's walking home with somebody on the way home. They're talking, they're talking, they're talking. They get to the point where they reach the front door of the guy's house. And without even understanding it, he says, I'm sorry, Mola, your house was way back then. We kept talking and we lost track of time. And Imam Ali says to him that I knew exactly what I was doing. I walked with you this far because I wanted to help you get to your destination. And then I'll come back by myself to my destination. Because helping you get to your destination is like helping myself. There's khair inside of it. Many times people ask me, oh Malana, I have the niyat to give this amal khair to my father marhum, for example. I remember in my first year in Qom, my father marhum lived 52 years. Never went to one ziyarat. Never had time, never had money. Not one hajj, not one umrah, not one ziyarat. Nothing, not once in his life. I land in Qom in 2004. Within months later, I'm in Mashhad. I go to my teacher, I ask him, like, I want to make this ziyarat all about my father. Can I make that niyat or not? He goes, you can make that niyat. 110% every step of the way that you leave from Qom to Mashhad is for your father. But know that your Allah is so kareem, so generous. He'll give it to you, he'll give it to your father as well. Don't think for a moment that Allah is that bakhil, God forbid. He's that stingy, God forbid. He only has sawab for that person. While you're helping that person get to their destination, Allah is also showering you with His barakat and His rahmah and His mercy as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So please, let's try to kill this idea that the me aspect. Let's adopt this idea that our parents had right, that you have to be concerned about those around you. These are people, if you belong to the community, you belong to a extended family, these are people that you have to live with on a daily basis. So yes, there are moments where you should be concerned to a certain extent about what they might think of my decision. How will it affect everybody around me? Right? It's a very beautiful way of looking at it. On top of that, we should always, always make it a point to create this culture within our communities to help each other out. To look out for each other's iman. Small things, like if somebody takes off their hijab, God forbid, have a conversation with her. So what happened, sister? You were doing so well that something happened. Not only do we do that, but sometimes, you know, a person does something that's haram in Islam, breaks Allah's commands, puts it on social media, and then we have comments of saying, oh, you look great, mashallah, way to go, was it fun, how was it, oh my God, you went there, I can't believe you were there, OMG, this and that, all this, all over social media. These are people who are pious, who are promoting that sin, for example. So not only are you not saying anything, but you're promoting the evil as well. Why? Because, you know, why should I say anything? Who am I to say anything? I'm not a doctor to prescribe her medication. She knows she's sick, that's it. I'm not asking you to give prescriptions, but I am saying that we should have a culture where if somebody has a runny nose and a cough, you should be able to say, you know what, maybe you should go see a doctor. Your cough has been coughing for the past 3 weeks to a month. You've been coughing for the past 6 months. Maybe it's time for you to go see a doctor. That's all I ask of you. But we don't even think that. We know a person right now for sure is becoming the awliya of shaitan in front of our eyes. And right away we think about the individual. If I call him out, he's going to call me out. If I call him out, he's going to call me out. He's going to sit there and say, oh, you have the gall to tell me about what I'm doing wrong? Do you remember last Friday? Last month? Do you remember what you posted on Facebook? Really, bro? If I were you, I'd just kind of keep quiet. You're like, yeah, he's right. You walk away. And to avoid that embarrassment, we don't say a word at all. And if you have to take that, you take that. You have to understand the collective nature of the deen. The deen came as an ummah. The very first thing the Prophet did in Medina was he built a mosque. He built homes around the mosque. He put doors from the home to the mosque. The call of prayer is a collective call towards prayer. On the roof of the Kaaba, he would bellow it out. In the minars, he would bellow it out, just to make sure everyone comes towards Salat. Even the Day of Ghadir, look at the symbolism of the Day of Ghadir. There were many people who walked ahead of the Prophet, many people who were left behind. He waited until those who were ahead backed up and those who were behind caught up. So everyone was there for this monumental announcement. A collective announcement of Ghadir. Not an individual announcement. Not a whispering between individuals. No, it's a collective nature. So everything about the deen is collective. Where you have aqimus salat, you have atu zakat. Where you have individual worship, you also have charity for the ummah as well. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. And like I said, this great woman, this great lady was a woman who gave her life for the Holy Prophet. who never once for a moment questioned, are you sure that the path is right? Are you sure what you're doing is correct? Her last years in Shibli Abu Talib got to the point where she had no money left for even a coffin for her own body. She was buried in the Abba of Rasulullah. A woman who was, as many of you know, very, very successful in her business. And some of the richest Arabs at that time would come and beg for her hand in marriage. Beg for her hand in marriage. She would say no to everybody. She would want to marry the Holy Prophet. And yes, it was her that sent the rishta for the Holy Prophet. It was her that sent the proposal for the Holy Prophet. I want that pious man to be my husband. I don't want the rich Arabs. So money didn't corrupt her. Success didn't corrupt her. She understood that, you know what, I can have the riches of the Arabs. I don't want that. This money means nothing to me. I want to tread his path and live beside him in my life. Her last few days, some say that she caught a fever in Shibli Abu Talib. Some say she was poisoned by something she ate at Shibli Abu Talib. But as she was leaving this world, the Holy Prophet is there, Amir al-Mu'mineen is there, Asma bint Umais is there, and a four-year-old Sayyidah Fatima is right there by her bed. Sayyidah Fatima was 4 years old when her mother passed away. And as she's leaving this world, she turns to Asma bint Umais and says, Asma, look after my Fatima. Every mother, every girl, every child needs the support of a woman in her life. And no doubt, our condolences go to Shahzadi Fatima Zahra, that tonight you lost your mother at the age of four. It's devastating. You were yatim at the age of four. But I do know that once your mother left this world, your father came, hugged you, and kissed you, and told you, don't worry, you still have me. The women around at that moment came and perhaps put their hand on her head. They let her grieve for her mother. They told, don't worry, we are here now for you. We will be your mother. We will be your guardian. We will be your parent. You won't be left alone. That's what should happen when a four-year-old loses her parents. But you come to the Zindan of Sham, there's a four-year-old there as well. And that four-year-old is in a dungeon, in a prison, in the same burnt clothes from the day of Ashura. Her father also has left this world. But where there should be hugs and kisses, there's slaps across her face. Where there's hugs and kisses, there's earrings ripped out of her ears. Where there's hugs and kisses, there's torn, burnt clothes on her back. They say that Bibi Sakina, 4-year-old, this is no yatim should ever go through this at 4 years old. In the middle of the night, one night, she sees her father in her dream. Imam Hussein on one side, Bibi Sakina on the other. Imam Hussein begins to cry. She says, Baba, what's wrong? Saying, Sakina, you know that no house is sukoon and serene without you. I miss my Sakina. I wish you were beside me. I wish you were with me. And she begins to cry as well. And then Imam Hussein says to Sakina, that don't worry, Sakina, very soon you'll be with me as well. And then he's gone from the dream. In the middle of the night, Sakina wakes up crying, crying. Bibi Zainab says, what's wrong? She says, I smell my Baba. I can see my Baba. I heard my Baba. Somebody call my Baba. She begins to cry to the point where Yazid now begins to wake up. What's this noise I hear? It's the daughter of Hussein. How do I quiet her? Send her the head of her father. The head of the father is brought to a four-year-old Sakina inside. They're inside the Zindan of Sham. There is a head that's brought. Bibi Sakina begins to kiss the head of Imam Hussein. Hey Baba, there's blood all over your face. Who did this to you, Baba? Your head is severed. Who did this to you, Baba? She begins to cry and cry and cry to the point where there wasn't any noise from her prison. Bibi Zainab wakes up one morning for Fajr, calls out to Sakina. There's no answer. Sajjad, go see what's wrong. Sakina's not responding. Imam Sajjad enters the Zindan, lying there, clutching the head of her father. Bibi Sakina has left this world. Imam Sajjad says, Puppi Amma, she's gone. Puppi Amma comes. Imam Sajjad comes. And together they bury the four-year-old daughter of Hussein ibn Ali. سَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. فاطمة حسين يا حسين.